Hello, and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi. A podcast in which three extraordinarily random people read audiobooks or listen to them, whatever that means, and give you first a review, then a terrifying analysis.
It's always terrifying.
Are we really all that random since, you know, since the last 50 plus episodes, it's been the three same random guys?
I mean, basically, we're the result of blind cosmic processes, so we're the result of randomness. Nihilism world. Nihilism world. It's an amusement park that I'm opening.
On the other hand, this could be the culmination. All of history has converged to this podcast. This is the culmination of all civilization.
All right. So let's see. Whose choice was it this week?
This was mine.
What are we reading this week?
Null States by Malka Older.
Could you tell us from the back of the book?
The future of democracy is about to implode.
Too late!
After the last controversial global election, the global infomocracy that has ensured 30 years of world peace is fraying at the edges. As the new supermajority government struggles to establish its legitimacy, agents of information across the globe strive to keep the peace and maintain the flows of data that feed the new world order. In the newly incorporated Darfur, a governor dies in a fiery explosion. In Geneva, a superpower hatches plans to bring micro-democracy to its knees. In Central Asia, a sprawling war among archaic states threatens to explode into a global crisis. And across the world, a shadowy plot is growing, threatening to strangle information with the reins of power.
All right. Kevin, what did you think this time?
Overall, I liked it, though I think it took me a couple reads to get to that point. Mm-hmm. I think political intrigue over fictional places is not my thing. But, you know, my special job is to make things sound worse than they are. So,
oh boy, this is going to be so good.
Is it your job or your superpower?
Both. I play to my strengths. meaning that it's easy for me to make things sound much worse than my initial
that phrase you used the other day, praising with faint damnation.
Yes. Basically.
Wow. I missed that.
So anyway, yes, I did like it. It took me a bit to get into it at first. And I think for me, I really enjoyed the setting and the world building more than I enjoyed, you know, parts of the plot, I guess. So, yes, it does sound like that. But anyway, yeah, I actually kind of fixated more on some of the interesting ideas. You know, the narrative disorder thing was interesting, partly to figure out what exactly it was, and partly just it was interesting, with the ideas that kind of cropped up in her mind. But also I kind of like the technology where everyone's like, you know, kind of, it didn't really explain exactly as far as I could tell, but, you know, having some kind of implant or some kind of contact lens, like, you know, heads up display with like, you know, earpiece translators like Star Trek or something. So,
right. Everybody is running around with these heads up displays that lets them access information on everything. And so this particular story mostly focuses on trying to bring a recent null state that is now just entering information into the fold and trying to get them to adopt the civilized ways of this sort of, you know, Googleocracy.
Information runs everything.
Well, information is great and shall prevail.
Well, because I actually reread the Infomocracy after I read this, and, you know, just to kind of compare it. And, you know, the first one did do a lot more kind of world building about micro-democracy itself and the different kinds of sentinels that exist and stuff, which I actually really liked from the first book. There was less of that in this book.
Right. And remind our listeners what a sentinel is.
So what is it, 100,000 people that have voted to be in a certain government, basically.
Right.
And I guess they split up into these 100,000 person gerrymandering, whatever.
It is very much like self-gerrymandering, yes.
Yeah.
Right. But it's different because you do it to yourself.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I don't think they ever said this is how we did the lines, but they did mention it was always contentious to do it and is never perfect. And that actually caused some of the potential problems with drawing borders in these states, you know, when they were done or something.
Okay. Barry, what did you think?
I liked it. It was as Kevin mentioned, it was a lot more political intrigue, I think, in this one, and it really drove the overall plot. The technology, again, it's very much a continuation of the first book, so they didn't spend a lot of time going into how much of it worked, but it's all very interesting that, you know, they spent some time as well, you know, talking about how there's like espionage using this personal technology, right? You didn't want to have, you know, the brightness too high on your display because people could be looking at your eyes and basically recording that
right.
that stuff that's showing up, and you're kind of, you know, paging through stuff and they're picking off all this data. But it was good. I liked it.
Right. This was a series that lives and dies on its world building, and the world building is really strong because she's got all of this technology that is used to promote this sort of radical form of democracy where every sentinel, every 100,000 people, you said?
I think that's right, yeah.
Gets their own state and can vote in their own government. And, you know, it's sort of this almost utopia of democracy, but there are a lot of...
Remember, democracy is mob rule.
Exactly. There's a lot of complication and... what has to happen in order to have this kind of democracy is not just a free press, but a like super Google type of free press that does things like annotates somebody's, you know, speech. You know, let's say there's a terrorist attack and they carefully annotate every news report about it, saying, okay, yes, there was a terrorist attack, but you're still far more likely to die of heart disease.
Right. Yeah. Basically, everything hinges upon it being as accurate as possible with all information reporting. So, yes, everything is annotated to the point that, you know, at the beginning of the book, you know, extremely minor spoiler, they go to a restaurant and the pictures are...
There are restaurants in this book.
Yes.
Whoa.
The pictures are stock pictures of food, not the actual food that they have there. And so she's writing up a little citation about, well, this isn't your actual picture. So, you know, you have a week to change this or whatever it is. Otherwise, we'll just put in whatever real pictures we find online.
Right. And she's just doing the equivalent of a Wikipedia, you know, citation needed.
Right.
And they take it as accusations of lying.
Right. You know, information is telling us what to do. So... We'll get into that, I guess, in the spoiler bits.
What they really needed to do was, you know, read your mind on what you're going to order and then produce a photo of what you were about to be served so you would never be disappointed, right?
Right. And then transfer that back in time. So that was what caused you to order it in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. it's a simple operation, right?
Right. Change the gravitational constant of the universe. Anyway, so yes. Well, I think it's time for us to secede from the union that we call the reviews section so that we can rejoin it later in our discussion section.
Fly away in our crow. Hopefully it doesn't explode.
We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion section. So... As usual, we'll begin with favorite scenes. Anybody got any favorite scenes? I think we have several in common.
I did like, towards the end of the book, there was the, you know, Mishima had the rollerblade fight scene, you yes. know, where her cover is already blown, but now it's really blown. And because her cover had been blown and I guess all the news compilers were just auto searching for her in any of the feeds, it's like, hey, we found her. And so it's like live televised over the entire globe, this like fight scene with some other spies that were attacking her on a rollerblade. So it was very cinematic.
Right. I mean, we have Mishima, this gorgeous super spy, you know, martial artist with narrative disorder, and we'll get into narrative disorder. And so, yes, and she happens to be rollerblading home. I didn't actually catch why she was rollerblading.
I'm not sure.
And yes, she's beset upon by thugs and basically turns it into this incredible ballet, you know, fight scene thing. And I think by the end of the day, it had already been incorporated into several games or something like that.
Right. Like there's a new manga or something coming out based on her, supposedly, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, Nike was like, hey, can we like, you know, have you sponsor our rollerblades? And yeah, I was also kind of wondering, like, well, how do they deal with like sort of, you know, owning your personal identity in this world, because it's like, you know, her image was used on all these random things that had nothing to do with her or even any of the topics. It was just like, hey, this is a recognizable image right now. Let's put this on things so people will buy it.
Right.
And so it's like, you know, I'm not sure how that is even done now, whether you can kind of claim, I guess it's how public you are, really, you know, whether your image can be used without your permission in some cases, I think.
I think we couldn't take LeVar Burton's image to pick a random person that we mentioned earlier off mic and just say LeVar Burton's sci-fi without right. his permission.
But could we put his name as our new icon or his image as our new icon and say, hey, and then just, you know, that's implying that there's some association maybe, but if they're really famous, then in news you for sure can do it, but when it's related to products or even free things, it's kind of more ambiguous for sure.
We should talk about this more. Barry.
It's yes. important.
I mean, there was something, anything.
There was an episode of The Simpsons about this, right?
Where, oh dear God, we're still on this.
There was a picture of Homer's, you know, face on a box of soap from Japan, right?
That one was awesome.
And Mr. Sparkle or
Mr.
something?
Mr. Sparkle. Yeah.
That was an awesome episode.
Where it turned out to be like a fish and a pair of eyeballs that sort of swam together in the end or something.
Yeah, something like that. But it was just more him just being completely like, how is this even possible? What? It doesn't make any sense.
It's like, I'm so confused. My identity has been stolen.
All right. Okay. I guess we've done that. So.
Wait, there's more.
Oh, is there?
Well, give me a moment. I can think of something.
No.
A favorite scene, maybe?
Yes. Do you have another favorite scene?
I did actually have a favorite scene. There was a point where she's setting up a fake background when she goes to East Asia, to the China region, and she starts working in with these other kids and stuff, and they're talking about sort of like this, you know, futuristic cube farm factory where it's not actually cube walls anymore, but they actually have holographic displays and are sort of encouraged to put up, you know, their latest work because they're working on, you know, manufacturing content.
Right.
Right. And so you basically walk into this area where it's, you know, all these projections are dividing off desks, but it's constantly like shifting and changing. And
it did feel very like Blade Runner or Max Headroom or something.
Yeah. It made me think a lot of, you know, some of the scenes from Blade Runner. You know, and I'm thinking about, you know, sort of like the modern cube farms now that you're starting to see, and they're getting smaller and smaller. And, you know,
you don't even need walls. You just project them.
It's just an open office now.
I mean, why wouldn't I just project, you know, some happy scenes or, you know, maybe some scenes that would drive other people away to keep them away from my desk.
Didn't you have some sort of form that you made people fill out back at a place we used to work that just had a really scary face on it at
the
beginning?
Well, I had the Ren and Stimpy happy helmet with his, like, you know, bloodshot eyeballs, and he was super happy. And he was basically like, yeah, it just said, I'm busier than you think. Please fill out this work request form with like a link to the URL, but I printed out the page and put it on my outside wall.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So then moving on, who in terms of character or faction would we like to be in this book? I'm starting to think Switzerland. Switzerland.
You don't want to be part of micro-democracy?
Well, micro-democracy is pretty awesome, but, they, at one point, they sort of chase somebody into Switzerland, and right. It's all classic cars. I don't really like classic cars that much, but
the concept is cool. It's very Brazil-like.
Yes.
That's okay. In the future, you know, the classic car you'll be encountering in Switzerland in this case will be your current car.
That's true.
So it'll all be fine, right? You won't know the difference.
So a Prius held together with duct tape.
I thought it was gaffer's tape.
I was trying to translate for the studio audience, but sure.
Gaffers are used in studios.
sometimes.
Just completely blanked my mind of anything.
that was worth it then.
So Switzerland is one of the states where they actually still have strong privacy.
Right. Yeah, the other one being, I think that it's not exactly privacy first, but there's a Sentinel where their entire thing is privacy. I do like all of the different ranges of of Sentinels, such as there's one that's actually just run by celebrities.
Oh, right. Yeah. They're like, please vote for us because you recognize us. Like, right. Yep, that's kind of how it works now, right? But yeah, actually the privacy thing I thought was funny because they said there were two Sentinels in the world, you know, of this type. And one of them was in California. And so I was kind of like, well, where was that supposed, is that supposed to be like a liberal area or is it like, you know, very right wing kind of, you know, privacy area, but you know, it could kind of wrap
more
around
to hide.
Right.
Well, yeah, I was kind of like, you know, is it, you know, is this, I'm just wondering if Malka Aldred was like, had a particular place in mind in California where she's like, oh, this would be the privacy place.
I mean, I'm guessing it's, you know, you swing one way or the other on, you know, left or right. And, you know, so the left option would probably be someplace like Berkeley.
Right. I was wondering, it was like, is it Berkeley or is it like, you know, something bizarre, Humboldt, like it's Esalen or something.
Maybe it's the Free State of Jefferson or something. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Although I liked your positing that it's just the EFF.
Yeah. know, Sentinel. It'd make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
All right. Anybody else who you would like to be?
I think if I had to align myself with one of the groups, it would have to be information.
Sure.
You know, they seem to be in control of everything. They sort of become like a de facto, you know, ruler in a lot of cases. You know, they're issuing rules about, you know, what the density of cameras has to be when you join micro-democracy. And
well, it seems to be like a contract, citations. Right?
Right.
Like they're saying, like, you enter into a contract to be part of this democratic construct, and you have to fulfill this certain amount of thing, and you get a certain budget from them somehow, or I don't know how that works, because they were kind of like implying that they weren't using their camera budget, you know, in the book, or not more than implying, but
yeah. But I mean, it's interesting the way they, you know, the way it was characterized, you know, when they were talking about the camera density or the information feed density, they almost sounded like they were sort of talking down about the population because they hadn't implemented, right? It wasn't just a fact that it wasn't done, you know, it was almost like a social negative.
Like they were, like it was this backwards area or something.
Right. The term null state was being used as a pejorative.
Right. For that's for parts of the world that still hadn't even become part of micro-democracy.
Right.
You know, you were still considered a null state. So therefore you didn't matter or, you know, looked down upon.
They couldn't get the information to find stuff out about. Cause yeah, everything seems to be this huge, like data mining, you know, problem now where you just, if you want to find something or find out where someone's been, you're like, well, like, you know, at some point, you know, Mishima is trying to look something up about somebody and just sort of, well, let me just, you know, follow four weeks back to see everywhere that this person's walked and I could see them talking to this person. And cause everything's on camera, like in England now or whatever, where it's just like, you know,
and this is probably CCTV. What our current world would look like to somebody from say the 80s.
Right. And they do kind of, it's funny because they say you just get used to it, you know, that everywhere you just are on camera and they kind of say, you know, if you're semi-paranoid, you just think there's so many cameras that what's the probability that anyone's going to actually be looking at you at any one time, right? You know, mm-hmm. pretty low. But also the way they were talking is...
well, Kevin, what do you have to hide?
Of course, nothing. towards the end when Roz kind of stumbles on the... you know, those agents that I thought was interesting where they were like, they had presumably some kind of help to help them walk outside of the information feeds.
Right.
They knew where everything was pointed so they could.
Right. You know, so they were
pre-programmed routes to avoid camera feeds.
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way to kind of stay outside of information that you can look up. But yeah, so I forgot my train of thought now.
I mean, to me, it was... You know, I immediately started thinking of, you know, if this were happening today, like here in California, that you'd immediately have, you know, some fairly intelligent people that would be out there painting routes onto sidewalks and saying, if you follow this path or stay between these lines, right, you won't be seen on cameras.
Right.
Right.
That
and that would be part of your augmented reality stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, but it's never really mentioned in the book, right? You know, explicitly as... You know, it's a social phenomenon. It's always individual actors that are doing this sort of thing, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I would think that in this world that AI would have a much stronger presence.
Yeah, that is something that was largely missing from the book. I mean, there's some ideas of low-level machine learning, I think, but...
Well, I think it's kind of implicit that they have to be doing some kind of, you know, AI aggregation behind the scenes for a lot of this stuff, because you couldn't go through every possible feed and like look, you know, for someone's face, I mean, right?
It seems like it's highly restricted to things like indexing video and
right. And it's like documents. Super Google or whatever, and like information is kind of what that's what they do,
right?
And the people are in their spare time are always thinking of like, well, how would you design an algorithm to do this? You know,
as part of the Information Technology Institute, I would like to propose that we start using AI to do all the jobs of the information agents.
Exactly.
Thereby, you know, claiming, you know, several billion dollars worth of savings.
Yay. Okay. All right. So one of the things that comes up in the book is narrative disorder. And that's one of those things that is tossed off like we should already know what it is. Now, there's supplementary material on the website that talks quite a bit about what narrative disorder is and how Mishima has it. But they do talk about how fashionable it is now to claim that you have narrative disorder or pretend you have narrative disorder, even if you don't. And it's a form of paranoia, but it seems to be part of this information-rich culture where you sort of get lost in other people's narratives really easily, and that you form narratives around whatever it is that you're doing and just believe right. that.
Yeah, I mean, in the, you know, Malcolm Older, I guess, has this narrative disorder story of that title. And at the beginning, they talk about, you know, Mishima is diagnosed when she's a child. And they kind of say, well, you know, it's not a bad thing. We don't know that much about it. So, you know, maybe it's changed. But in the beginning of it, they basically say, you know, she'll construct a narrative around any bits of data and make it into a story,
right.
you know, that are totally not connected or are and just whatever seems to make the most narrative sense to her.
I mean, it almost sounds a lot like, you know, sort of just being able to freely daydream about, you know, whatever it is you're looking at. You know, and construct its, you know, a different reality almost.
I mean, mostly it sounds to me like a symptom of being human. I mean,
well, right. Humans are especially designed to find patterns and things, right? But it's like turned up to 11. Like.
Exactly. And so, you know, this sort of incredible tendency to put everything in patterns, which also has, you know, side effects of paranoia, because that's basically what paranoia is, you know, seeing things and connecting them, but generally, you know, connecting them a little bit too far. And, you know, the only way sometimes that you can keep on connecting things is assuming that everybody's in a conspiracy against you.
Right. And so, you know, Mishima, you know, this is her, essentially her superpower for her job, mm-hmm. Is that she, you know, can look through the data and, you know, she'll dream up a lot of things that are not true. But then, you know, what usually tends to happen in the story is she'll stumble on something and say, well, this seems to fit it. And then when she analyzes it logically, it's like, okay, that doesn't seem completely, you know, off kilter and unlikely. And so, but because it's considered a disorder, you know, she'll tell other people in her organization about it. And, you know, if it's a little bit out there, they'll be like, is this just your narrative disorder talking? And
right.
You know, she's like, it's not how it works. Like,
I mean, it's a sort of akin to like when people say that, you know, someone sees all the angles, mm-hmm. right? You're able to pick out things before other people, you know, the patterns in the data.
Right, exactly. But it also made me think a little bit, I'm not really sure if Malka Older is going for a more specific point that she thinks that there are more people like this, or if she's actually going for a larger societal point, because it makes me think so much about how much about the world, at least how much about the world for me, I have learned through fiction and, right. you know, and so part of my brain really believes that if you shoot a gun at a car, it will probably explode.
Have you ever tried?
No, but I have watched Mythbusters.
Yes, that reminds me of, oddly enough, this is, you know, the first time I got a car that actually had a remote on mm-hmm. it. Because it had, you know, for whatever reason, I just didn't have one for years after they were kind of common. And the first like month that I would hit it and it would go beep, my brain was waiting for my car to explode after that. It's like, I know it's not going to happen, but it's like, I'm waiting for the next step.
Exactly. That could be the other reason that narrative disorder is paranoia. So for me, the big question is this supposed to be a utopia, a dystopia, or something in between?
I think it's a poorly implemented utopia. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds a little facetious, but I actually think that the idea of micro-democracy and sentinels, if it were implemented without obstruction from other entities for their own self-serving, you know, greed, might actually be a good thing. I think that, to me, I was trying to figure out who the antagonist was in this book. I mean, there's an obvious one of, you know, somebody who's trying to upset the micro-democracy system. But right. Then I started to, you know, sort of get like this feeling of why they're fighting, sort of why they're fighting against the information system,
right?
Which is really like a super governmental agency, mm-hmm. you know, and it right to the point in the book where they, I think it's Roz says, "You're under pre-arrest."
Right? Preliminary arrest.
Preliminary arrest. Right. I was right. like, wow, they've actually separated the different stages of arresting someone now that there is a preliminary arrest. I see you have now fully weaponized, you know, the information system.
It's like bureaucracy in all its glory.
It is. I mean, it's kind of, you know, if you think of like Futurama and, you know, Hermes belongs to the, you know, the, what is it? The great accounting group that, you know, has the bureaucracy, right? Mm-hmm. And he has to go through machinations to, you know, basically get anything done. It kind of felt like there's like so much regulation on each sentinel and how they're supposed to do their business. Right, that you're actually almost stifling something.
Well, for me, there are two sort of warring things going on in my brain, because on one hand, I think artistic free expression is a really important thing. But on the other hand, I think that we are harmed when there's like even basic marketing, like, oh, this is what the food, you know, should look like. It's not what it actually looks like, but what we're trying to convey is not actually what the food looks like. We can't impel the smell through the, you know, and the experience of eating it. So we're just trying to brighten up the food so that it conveys this is really good.
I mean, like in a current analogy, right, there's supposed to be these new laws that say you have to provide, you know, calorie counts for foods at restaurants, mm-hmm. right? If you're over a certain size or something.
Sure.
You know, what if it's off by 10%? What if it's off by 15% and you can prove it? Does that mean you get to go and sue them? I mean, is this like some sort of...
Actually, I wouldn't have a problem with that.
What if you weren't getting the calories you paid for?
You could probably sue them for that too.
Yay.
You know, it's just like sort of, you know, where does it end? You know, it's like earlier, I think Kevin was mentioning... Well, actually, we were just talking about the pictures, right? You know, it's like, well, you know, how often does your food actually look like what's on the menu at, you know, Burger King or something? Not to pick on them, but you're like, you get it and you look at it, you're like, this is kind of sad looking, but mm-hmm. you still eat it.
Yeah, exactly. And so on the one hand, you know, there are all these deceptive techniques that are used on us all the time to make us make bad decisions.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, life is more fun when you're surrounded by, you know, fun pictures of food and not, oh, yeah, this is...
You mean the truth is too scary?
It's just...
Here's your calorie brick, citizen.
Exactly.
Soylent.
I mean, it's one of those... it's one of those paradoxes that if people make, you know... It was something that I, from a talk by Julia Galef, who does the Centers for Rationality in San Francisco. I may have that wrong, but it was something I heard in a talk one time where people that make fully rational decisions, you know, they go through and check off all the boxes and total off up the, well, this is the good thing about this and this is the bad thing about this. They generally make the right, say, financial decision, but they're usually less happy with the experience overall.
Is that what's wrong with me?
Just one of the things.
I literally do make lists of pros and cons about some of my decisions.
Right. And
choose the one that has more pros than...
Yeah, and apparently... What generally happens there is people fail to go recursive and also incorporate
about me.
Your emotional states this would make me happier overall because it's kind of awesome.
Oh, they don't take into like emotional consideration into the pros and cons. They just take rational,
exactly
logical things.
Like, say, this recorder that this is being recorded on right now, completely overpowered for my purposes.
No, it's not. It's awesome.
Exactly.
It made you happy.
It is awesome. Okay, let's see. So,
I mean, not to, beat this into the ground, but, having just sort of recently rewatched The Matrix, there's a point where Agent Smith is describing the sort of the history of prior matrices,
right?
Where he says, well, we made the earlier ones too perfect and everybody just, gave up and died.
Right.
through sheer lack of, will to live. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. I think it's intended to be a utopia, but that it kind of comes after definite, like, a dystopic setting, especially outside, and that they're trying to change, and like that, especially like, they don't talk about it a lot directly, but there's definitely like ecological things that have happened where they talk about like rising, like, lost coastlines from rising floodwaters and stuff like that. And
right.
Of course, being me, I'm like, oh yeah, more of that, more.
Tell me more about the people that died. Yeah.
More apocalyptic destruction, please. Oh, but
terrifying.
But well, I will say that, and this is partly from rereading the first and the second book back to back. But I was, I was kind of like, oh yeah, I wouldn't mind living in a crow. And then, as far as I can tell, they don't explain exactly what it is, but my just projection, is it some kind of zeppelin or something,
right,
like
they
that?
They fly around in crows and what was it? Tsubamis?
I, because it's an audio, I have no idea how that's spelled. Mm-hmm. It seemed like the description of the crow was it could fit about 25 people in it if you just made a passenger, and the Tsubami was,
I mean, it sounds like some sort of
a couple
like,
people, one to two.
Right.
It really reminds me of some sort of like air, recreational vehicle or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, well, I kind of pictured that the Tsubami was more like a drone or something.
It's tempting to read these books as mystery stories. And I think the way that I've come to terms with it is they're not actually mysteries. They sort of follow the overall form of mysteries, but the big reveal at the end is usually somebody that you've never heard of. It's a little bit the Scooby-Doo ending sometimes. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in the first book did have some of that. In this one, like the secret informational government that we don't even, I think, reveal who that was.
Right.
Just that somebody's been filtering off information, and we see a couple of their agents that, and some get away. So yeah, I'm still unclear about that.
I mean, there's a couple of mentions earlier in the book about, the sort of like the, what they call it, like the internal communications,
right,
that they're using. And, at some point, Roz and Mishima finally pick up on the fact that there really is something going on.
Right. And most of it is the gradual discovery that something is going on. And in a lot of books, they would discover, oh, there's another rogue information, we think, out there. And then by the middle of the book, they would be sort of doing battle with it.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of that, the trope that you see a lot, like in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., right? Like there's a subgroup, like Hail Hydra is within S.H.I.E.L.D. And,
right.
It becomes, fully fleshed out. But here it's sort of just left as some statements, and
well, it
and
feels
pops out at the very, very end.
Yeah, it feels a lot more like it's trying to be not necessarily news, but it's like we're not adding our own conclusions, we're just like reporting some of the facts. So it's kind of like written as kind of a meta information structure or something.
Exactly. And I think that we would be accused of having narrative disorder.
But perhaps.
I think that, since we are reading a narrative and commenting on a narrative, I think she's just putting her pieces into place, and I'm hoping that this will all pay off in some future book.
Well, there's supposed to be a third one, right?
Yes, because as we've been talking about, the first book ends with all of these discovering that, say, Heritage is digging tunnels between the various pieces of, or rather the various governments that subscribe to it. So, basically digging these huge holes in the earth and possibly making like a big underground subway system.
I mean, don't we have someone that's currently kind of doing this now, except that he's doing it between his house and his office? Isn't that Mr. Elon Musk?
Oh, okay. Yes, he's been thinking about that.
The Hyperloop thing.
No, I think he wanted to build dig a tunnel from his house to his office because he was tired of commuting.
Yes, I mean, normally one just gets up earlier, but I guess when you're a billionaire, you can think of things like
how
that.
How about you just dig through the mantle of the Earth? Oh, that happened in this Doctor Who episode called Inferno, and then, you know, the Earth was destroyed in this parallel universe, so I don't know.
What can go right?
Well, and oddly
there's a
enough,
special form of narrative disorder called Whovian disorder.
Yes, I just saw this.
Oh, this can only go right.
Yes, I think I mentioned I'm semi addicted to this YouTube video series called Number File.
Yes,
and so this mathematician there called Matt Barker like has his own channel, and basically he's like, you know, if you fell through the center of the Earth, how long would it take? It turns out it's basically 42 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then after much more wrangling, it turns out, well, if you drill through the Earth from any point to any other point because of the differences in, you know, this and that, it's still 42 minutes. And he's like, in fact, that's like a normal constant. Anywhere that has the same general density of the Earth of any size will take 42 minutes to fall through. So I guess that's where Douglas Adams got that number right.
That's absolutely it. Keep digging.
And 42 minutes later. If only we could pad out this episode to 42 minutes.
I'm pretty sure we could if we wanted to.
Pop out the other side of some 42. Planetary.
42. Moving on, and not a moment too soon.
Oh, wow. That was a Doctor episode two, huh?
Yeah, it's a disorder.
There's multiple competing disorders at this table.
That's what he said when he regenerated that one time.
Dear God.
For reals.
What about furries?
Star furries.
Yes. That's a convention, right?
That, I'm going to mark that.
No, I think we actually need to have the Dar Furries convention.
No, I don't think we do. Anyway, where were we? Okay, usual questions. Was there tea? Actually, a fair amount of it. You know, they're going to get tea in the town square. They drink tea a lot. It's sort of a big deal there in wherever the heck they are.
Well, most of the time is spent, I think, in North Africa and the Middle East, and then they go to China. So, yes, there's how much tea is there in China?
A lot of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like all the tea in China.
Well, I thought the...
Never to be held back.
Dear God.
Well, what have I done?
Just a small amount about the fact that...
If you say Doctor Who episode...
This Doctor episode... Jesus. No, about the fact that people from the outside seem to think information is a sort of oppressive entity, whereas people inside information think of them... We're just sort of like the people that go through Wikipedia making sure that you're not lying.
Right.
And then, you know, we only have a few general rules like, okay, guns are bad. If you want to be in play with us, you can't have guns. You know, so there's a few rules like that. But otherwise, basically, like internally to your state, you can do whatever you want. But everyone, you know, several times everyone's like, your information, aren't you all powerful? Don't you know everything?
Right.
You know, so it's like they're the empire kind of coming in and like, you know, exactly. Saying, you know, we're this regime and you're going to do exactly what we say. And you know, but if you don't, you can't really talk to other people.
I used to work for a search agency. I mean, it wasn't one of the major ones in some, well, it was one of the major ones.
It was originally.
It was briefly a major one. Yes.
But yeah, you don't learn. You know, you don't become all powerful or have any special access to the search engine from working at the company.
You get access to the true results.
Yeah. Then they filter all that stuff out for the populace, right? I know that's how it works.
Mostly they get half of their, I think half of the users were actually just people that worked at the company. And so they were just ad serving internally.
I can help automate this.
I'm sure. Just a random
maybe
brain.
I did.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. Okay, well then, I think our crow has arrived for our trip out of here. So until it suffers a mysterious malfunction, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi. Hail Hydra.